Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Coming up tomorrow, Mark Gunn of the Buffalo News on Buffalo. High school football previews tomorrow with our announcers. That'll be between 3:35 and 4. Mark Gunn at 4:06. Greg Pickle, Penn Live on Friday. And also coming up on Friday will be Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report. Kevin Herr is here. One quick note on Spygate. And the Don Van Atta article is very extensive. You notice how the Patriots like sort of deny part of whatever, and part of what they denied happened to be taping the walkthrough of the Rams before the Super Bowl? You notice that the denial included that?
I didn't specifically, but...
Okay. You want to know what's really interesting about that? It's not even in the article.
So they denied something that wasn't in the article anyway.
Exactly. It's not in the article. Yeah. Okay. Did you read it?
Listen, anybody that wears a hoodie to press conferences to try and cover himself up kind of looks shady to me anyway, so...
Okay, but this is their publicity department that did this, that put that statement out. It's not even in the article. It's not even alleged. And then the other part was, what was the other part? Oh, the other part of the article that just struck the living daylights out of me was where Goodell called Mike Martz and asked him to put out a statement for the good of the league. What? And then Martz says, now rereading the statement years later, he looks at it, he says, a couple things I don't think I actually said, which means the league wrote it. I'm sorry. If you can't do things right, don't do them. Stop hiding behind little phrases, words, spin. If you can't do it right, don't do it. Stop spinning. You got to stop spinning. You can't sit there every 2 seconds and look at your publicity department and tell, hey, come up with a way of phrasing it. Okay. For the good of the league, say this. For the good of the league, say what? It has nothing to do with this. If they did it, they did it. Then dock them hard.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how has Roger Goodell handled the NFL and its issues in his tenure? Compared to past commissioners?
It depends, okay? TV contracts, brilliant.
Okay.
TV contracts, brilliant. Look at the numbers they're getting.
I can't argue with you there. I got you.
I mean, they get $1.9 billion a year just for Monday Night Football. Okay, that's not $1.9 billion for the whole package. That's for 15 games. So the TV contract, A+. Handling the NFLPA and the negotiations and the lockout, probably a B+, because they shouldn't have missed any time nor any games. How he's handled player discipline and how he's handled team discipline, D.
And didn't he come into this position saying how harsh it was going to be?
Right, but why do you destroy the Spygate tapes and notes?
That
take them, put them in a, okay, look at it, put it in a vault, say here it is, it's gonna sit there, right? But why are you destroying it? Why destroy evidence? That makes no sense. How the Brady thing with the Wells report was just a 7-month soap opera of absurdity over an equipment violation. Really? Okay, spinning out someone in that office should be fired for spinning out false statements to reporters that were then reported. The footballs were 2 pounds under. They weren't. And in fact, they had to release the two gauge reports. And again, why do you believe one gauge and not the other gauge? The one that shows that they're actually pretty much in the ballpark, you don't believe that one, but you believe this one. I don't know which one's faulty. It's just, the whole thing's absurd.
And which gauge was certified by an independent counsel?
You know, the Ray Rice thing handled poorly. I said right away, but without even seeing the inside of the elevator. What did I say right away without seeing the inside of the elevator? Okay? 8 games or up to October 31st, don't have him play during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. That sound tough enough to you? When it comes to abuse of women, as opposed to 2 games? And everybody's got to be, and all of a sudden they show the inside, whoa, got to backpedal away, whoa, hey, come on.
I just think for a guy who came into the league saying that he was going to be so harsh and everything, you know, and this was going to be tightened up and we're going to clean this up. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. I don't see anything other than, I will concede, the TV contract is massive and
well
done.
That's the big job.
But
that's the big job. Okay. That makes everybody money. Everybody makes money because of how he negotiated it, along with Kraft and along with Jerry Jones. Everybody's getting rich based on what he's doing. Good business model. Good, but the stop spinning. Okay, just meet it head on. Take care of it. And guess what? If you do that, people respect it. Don't spin it. When you spin it, people think you're lying. And that's in anything. Anytime you spin it, and spin something, they think you're lying. Just meet it head on, use facts to back up your argument, and go on. Oh, just, there are a lot of people and a lot of firms that do publicity and do, you know, crisis management and the whole thing. You know what? And to me, some of them, not all, some of them are stealing money. Let's bring in Donnie Collins. Donnie, welcome. Great to have you with us.
How you doing?
You're doing great. Just what you wanted to do. Talk to me about Penn State football.
Actually, I'd like to talk about the perfect game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're right. I mean, that was the Vin Scully call of that is, you know, something that you hear every 5 years now. You know, it's the anniversary, but you're right. I mean, writers do have a lot a chance to kind of think about those words and put them into the action. But you know, he's been like a writer saying things for years now. He's the best.
Yeah, I agree, because, I mean, obviously I've had historical calls I've made in my career, and to think of what he did to come up with that call at that moment, is back when, wow, he's special. All right, so what did you see Saturday?
Saw a team that really struggled to build on what it had built on at the end of last season. I'm surprised. I'm not surprised that the offensive line had some problems. I'm surprised that they didn't communicate very well. And I thought it might be a talent issue. I was that had occurred to me last year that maybe this group wasn't as good as it needed to be to be competitive. But to see that they continue to have the communication issues that they're not picking up the right extra blitzer, that they're getting beat physically, you know, on the two-man rush is the one everybody talks about. But there were some times that, you know, Temple rushed three or four and beat Penn State 5 up front. And, you know, the communication issues, I think, are probably the most troubling thing that came out of that game on Saturday, because they're a direct correlation to the loss. Well, once you get through those first couple of drives that everybody scripts now anyway, and they're all well schooled. They know what they're going to do going into a game now. So it's tough to screw those up. But once the game starts settling in, you have to make adjustments, and you have to kind of adjust to what the other teams are doing. Penn State failed miserably in that regard against a team that, you know, it's a good team. Temple's a pretty good team, but talent-wise, I don't think they have what Penn State has, and that has to be to suffer an all-time loss like that in your opener in a season when everybody had a lot of high hopes. Sure. I don't know how that can't be demoralizing.
As you watch from the box, Donnie, you get a wider view of the field. Were Penn State receivers getting some separation?
Well, it's hard to tell. I didn't think they were. I think these receivers, pretty much, except with the exception of Godwin, I think he got. There were a few times where he had some chances to break big plays, but Hamilton's a guy that I think you got to get the ball to relatively close to the line and let him do his work that way. Geno Lewis, to me, is a possession receiver. He's good on the slants. You know, a guy who can pick you up a couple of first downs if you can hold on to the ball, which he didn't do on that first drive on Saturday.
Right.
But we don't know about Polk. We don't know about Tompkins yet. Mm-hmm. Didn't see much of the Johnson, or any of Johnson. I'm not even sure. That's a group I want to look at again on Saturday because I like that Temple secondary. I think they're really good. Chandler's a really good player. But it was really difficult to tell if Hackenberg had no time or if they were trying to get the ball upfield and just couldn't do it, or if they weren't trying. And if they're not trying, why aren't they? I thought during the game they're running that sprint sweep there with Polk a couple times. Mm-hmm. Or they're taking that handoff and handing the ball up the middle. And I thought your natural progression here is they're going to go deep on that. They're going to fake it twice and then look deep. And they never did it. And Franklin said after the game that they were planning to and just never quite got around to it. I don't know what the weight was or if there was some kind of strategic thing that they didn't do. But, yeah, there were a lot of disappointing factors in this game. I thought the receivers were going to be a lot more dynamic than they were. Yeah. For Hamilton to only get a catch or two, and that can't happen.
Defensively, of the 64 plays that Temple ran, 15 were negative plays. 23% of them were losses, either two sacks or 13 tackles for losses in the game. But they ran the ball a couple times, and it looked, Donnie, to me like Temple did a great job of when Penn State went into its multiple defensive back package and sometimes went to a three-down lineman, Temple picked that spot to run the football. I thought that what they did was smart in terms of how they attacked it.
Oh, absolutely. I think fans aren't going to disagree with this, but Matt Rhule coached James Franklin in this game. It's no doubt. They got that funky defense where you're bringing all the defensive backs and you're playing pass coverage, and Temple's not just throwing the ball at the middle. They're kicking it outside. So they're getting out there, and Temple's receivers really, really blocked very well in the game. So once they're getting to the outside, they're sealing the edge, and that's what they're making their big ground. And, yeah, I saw the same thing. I don't know how Penn State fixes that. It's just they have to tackle better. But I'll tell you what, and this is something a lot of people have talked about, but you saw it immediately. It's hard not to see. You think the middle linebacker could really run out of there in Mortman, and they didn't have anybody who could chase anyone down sideline to sideline.
Right, and that does make a difference. I mean, there's no question that is a change, and especially when you talk about communication, he's the one that gets them into spots. I've used the example a couple times because, I mean, obviously you're privy to a couple things that maybe other people aren't. But, for example, last year Mike Hall was great at calling defenses, but he always had Wortman to bounce things off of, always did.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Michigan game, Hall, for one of the rare times, but Hall did, Mike put them into the wrong defense on a play, and Wortman corrected it. And it turned out that was the interception by Zettel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the kind of acumen that Naeem brings to the table.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Naeem's out of our area, so I know a lot about him. I've done a ton of stories. I did the Talon Gown feature on him this year. That was one of the things that really amazed me. The more I talk to people, Bob Shoup especially, the more you heard that Naeem was just as good as Mike Hall was.
Yes.
Getting the team in the right defense, making the calls. It was just as important. And something that Bob Shoup said to me a couple months ago, when I saw Naeem on the ground on Saturday, I thought of, and he said to me, look, there's no coincidence that the one game Naeem didn't play last year was the one where we really got pushed around.
That's Northwestern.
That was the Northwestern game.
Yep.
And as soon as my name went, I thought to myself, this is going to be interesting to see how they do without him. And then Temple, very clearly, they were going to attack the middle in that spot. They had to, the play didn't work, but they tried to run that middle screen, and Austin Johnson kind of blew it up. But the next play was a third and long. They hit over the middle, and they really had no problems after that. So, you know, they're going to have to adjust without Naeem. I think Jason Cabin is a good player. I think he's going to be able to, if he's the guy who's going to go in the middle with Reed or go on the outside or whatever they're going to do, I think they'll be okay in the long run this season. The question is, are they going to be okay soon? Because you don't lose a player like Paul very often to be able to replace him. And once you replace Hall with a guy who with that acumen out there, it's hard to replace that guy. Almost impossible to replace that guy, and I think Penn State's going to find that.
And here's the one that no one ever talks about. People are like, well, you know, you can go to this guy, go to this guy. You also lost Ben Klein there, too. And that's one where a veteran guy who has that same kind of acumen, where I think you would have felt you would be fine with him out there, but without having him, now you're down one more on the chart that you could have turned to.
Exactly. And I think very few people talk about this. Penn State's lost two guys in the last year, in Klein and Brenneman.
Yeah.
They really could use. I mean,
yes.
Klein, you can just throw into the middle. If Ben Klein's healthy, I'm not sure you can throw Naeem into the middle because he's such a dynamic force on the outside.
Right.
But now you've had a Naeem in the middle, and now he's gone. You would just throw Klein in there and expect, hey, that's a guy who wouldn't miss a beat. He'd be able to weave the defense, get them in the right spots, you know, everything that the middle linebacker is supposed to do. But now there's serious questions about whether that's even possible. It's for no fault of the players. It's you don't have that experience anymore. And it's kind of the same thing at tight end. I really don't think they have a true tight end, really, who can go out there and give them what they need, which is that extra block or the max protect. But Brenneman would have done that. So I think the injury situation, you know, it didn't seem like it was going to be that big a deal going into the game last week. But once Wortman's on the ground, you start thinking about it. They don't really have any replacements for the guy.
Yeah, suddenly you're down to your third middle linebacker, and then suddenly you're down to your fourth, and that fourth is a true freshman. That's why people say, yeah, how come you're not about your – excuse me, that's not how you went into the preseason, okay? And that's not how you were playing in the preseason, and that's how it played out. All right, now picking up and moving forward, what do you want to see from them this week? I mean, other than them winning the football game, what on level of play, what will you look for this week, Donnie?
You want them to protect Hackenberg. I think they could lose the game, and if Hackenberg doesn't get sacked, I think that's a positive step. Now, I don't think they will lose the game, but they have to be better up front than they were against Temple. You can't let Buffalo sack you five times, six times, seven times. You can't see the same breakdowns or anything like that. And I think what you really, if you're a fan, you want to sit there and say, all right, you want to walk out of Beaver Stadium on Saturday thinking, okay, that doesn't erase. Nothing they could have done in this game was going to erase the taste of what happened against Temple. But, you know, I could start to see where they're going with the offensive line, whether they make changes up there or not. You want to feel a little bit better about what's going on up there. And you want to see some of the playmakers, you know, those receivers you were talking about earlier, or even Akeel Lynch, make some big plays. And you want to think that hey, there's, you know, nothing really changed with the Temple game. Was it a bad loss? Yeah, historically, it's an awful loss. But it doesn't affect the Big Ten race. It doesn't affect, you know, going forward. It doesn't affect your bowl eligibility yet, you know, unless you end up winning five games. But you can still turn the season around, and you want to see some signs of hope. But every sign of hope this team is going to give you is on the offensive line, because if they don't start playing better, then I'm not sure this team could win six games.
Yeah, there was the only drive Penn State had over 2 minutes in the opening game. It happened to be the touchdown drive that went 241. There was not another drive over 2 minutes in the game, which meant the defense had to recycle and get back out in the field quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing they need to do, and it kind of touches on that, is they need to be a lot better on third down.
Agreed.
They picked one up after the second quarter started. They really struggled on third down because they were in third and long every time. But they're in third and long and picking up 1 or 2 yards. you know, they just didn't seem to have a go-to play or a go-to, you know, a go-to guy developed in that situation. And, you know, it was, I just think there was nothing the offense did right in that game after the first quarter. And you do need to see, if you're a fan in this game, you need to see something better than what you got from the offense.
Donnie, as always, thanks so much for giving us the time. I always enjoy it.
Yeah, me too, Steve. Thanks.
Donnie Collins, Grand Times Tribune. We'll come back bottom of the hour. We're going to have news. And then in the final half hour, we're a little slice of broadcast art 50 years ago today on News Radio 1070 WKOK. This year marks Sunbury Motor Company's 100th year in business, and we will be keeping the same tried and true values we've had ever since we opened our doors, guaranteeing your car buying experience will be smooth and hassle-free. No spinning a wheel for specials you don't need or want. No pushy sales staff pouncing on you as soon as you arrive. No sideshow yelling. Since we began back in 1915, we have strived to be your most trusted friend when it comes to all of your new car needs, whether that's in sales or service. We strive to offer you as many viable options as we possibly can. Sunbury Motor Company always carries a line of few other auto dealers in our area can compete with. With our inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there should be no problems with finding the right vehicle to fit your needs. Our friendly and trustworthy staff is knowledgeable in all of our products and stand ready to answer all of your questions and meet all of your needs. In honor of 100 years in business, SMC is introducing the all-new Auto Club, where Sunbury Motors will pay you for every mile you drive. Be sure to ask us about our Auto Club benefits. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com. Proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1950.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Great moments in history can be fun to relive. 50 years ago today, Sandy Koufax pitched a perfect game, which was also accompanied by what many would consider to be the perfect broadcast. Let me ask you something, Kevin. Sandy Koufax pitched in the majors 12 years. How many times did he win 20 games?
Seven.
Three.
Okay, so I should have cut it in half. I would have thought that was going to be a lot more.
No, that's my point. He won 18 and 19 in two other years, 14 in a year, but he had 25, 26, and 27. Now, those big numbers were actually at the end of his career. Well, he pitched a no-hitter in each one of the 62, 63, 64, and 65 seasons. The no-hitter 50 years ago today, he had not won a game in 3 weeks. And the last game, in fact, he had won before the perfect game was the infamous game where Juan Marichal took a baseball bat to Koufax's catcher, John Roseboro. He hadn't won a game since. He goes out there. This is a game where Lou Johnson walked in the fifth inning, was bunted to second, stole third, and on the throw to third, the ball went past Ron Santo and Johnson scored. That was the game's only run. So 50 years ago today, Vin Scully making the call. We pick it up with one out in the ninth inning. And listen, remember, this is all ad lib. No notes.
I would think that the mound at Dodger Stadium right now is the loneliest place in the world. Sandy, fussing, looks in to get his sign. 0-2 to Amalfitano. The strike two pitch to Joe. Fastball swung on and missed. Strike three. He is one out away from the promised land. And Harvey Keene is coming up. So Harvey Keene is batting for Bob Henley. The time on the scoreboard is 9:44. The date, September the 9th, 1965. And Koufax working on veteran Harvey Keene. Sandy into his windup, and the pitch, a fastball for a strike. He has struck out, by the way, five consecutive batters. And that's gone unnoticed. Sandy ready in the strike one pitch. Very high, and he lost his hat. He really forced that one. That's only the second time tonight where I have had the feeling that Sandy threw instead of pitched, trying to get that little extra. And that time he tried so hard, his hat fell off. He took an extremely long stride to the plate, and Torborg had to go up to get it. 1-1 to Harvey Keene. Now he's ready. Fastball high, ball two. You can't blame a man for pushing just a little bit now. Sandy backs off, mops his forehead, runs his left index finger along his forehead, dries it off on his left pants leg. All the while, Keene just waiting. Now Sandy looks in. Into his windup, and the 2-1 pitch to Keene. Swung on and missed. Strike two. It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. The perfect game. In right field. It is 9:46 p.m. in the city of the Angels, Los Angeles, California. And a crowd of 29,139. Just sitting in to see the only pitcher in baseball history to hurl four no-hit, no-run games. He has done it four straight years, and now he capped it on his fourth no-hitter. He made it a perfect game. And Sandy Koufax, whose name will always remind you of strikeouts, did it with a flourish. He struck out the last six consecutive batters. So when he wrote his name in capital letters in the record books, that K stands out even more than the O-U-F-A-X.
Art on the air. How about that? Trying to figure out what's better, Sandy Koufax's perfect game or Vin Scully's perfect call.
You know what it reminded me of? He kind of emulated that call when he was doing the work for the Love of the Game, the Kevin Costner movie about a perfect game.
Well, you know, but he puts the time in. Why does he put the time in? Because he knows that the pitcher will want a tape of the game because it's a great moment. So he wanted to give, he always, on a no-hitter, he puts the time in either just before a pitch or right after the pitch because he wants them to remember exactly the time of day it happened because it reinforces the moment. And he actually does that for the pitcher. He doesn't do it for the audience. How about that?
That's interesting. I did not realize that.
But remember, writers are outstanding at being able to turn a phrase, come up with an opening, put into words something that they see. Sometimes it's poetic, sometimes it's not. But they also have time to put it together. He ad-libbed every second of that. I mean, that's, you know, a writer comes up with, whenever you think of Sandy Koufax, you think of K's. And when you look at what he did today, that capital K is greater than the O-U-F-A-X. It's, you know, it's brilliant. One of the great items in for today, for me, is that Major League Baseball Network, MLB,
will carry games and not only use their guys, Bob Costas and Jim Cott and so forth, but they'll take local broadcasts and put them on the air. And there have been several times in the last couple of years where I've listened to Dodger broadcasts in the evening, late at night, maybe about midnight, whatever. And, of course, he's on doing the game. And also, by having Sirius XM in my car, and the Dodgers are at home, and I'll be driving back from doing a game someplace else, the first three innings are simulcast. I consider, as I listen to him, that to me it is a learning opportunity every time I hear him do a game. But that was 50 years ago today. And you know what? He's still broadcasting. How about that? Let's go to Keith in Danville. Hi, Keith.
How you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Good, good. Hey, I had a couple of questions for you, Saturday's game. A couple observations,
sure,
I made. I was a little troubled that I didn't see a whole lot of improvement from the line. I expected to at least see some improvement. And I know we got Palmer on there now. He's new, things of that nature. But I was hoping to see more improvement, number one. And the other thing that I didn't see that really troubles me is I didn't see adjustments being made by the coaching staff. And I guess that's the part that troubles me the most because, like I said, they're, you know, you can see they were pretty much doing the same thing. And I know I listened to what you said earlier about the scholarships and the sanctions and everything, and I agree with all. But at the same time, having him stand there flat-footed and he's getting killed just doesn't do it. And, you know, roll out of the pocket, you know, having Polk go down through the middle. They're vacating the middle because they're doing delayed blitzes with the linebackers. The middle's wide open. They're not taking advantage of the weaknesses that Temple was showing in the game, you know, to allow Hack to be successful. I just don't think they're building the offense around a quarterback his nature that, you know, that would make him successful. And the part that bothers me the most, though, like I said, is the fact that there just wasn't any adjustments. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Keith, that's interesting because I felt last year, for example, in the Central Florida game, I saw the adjustments you're talking about. In the Ohio State game, I saw the adjustments you're talking about. In the Boston College game, they're down 21-7. I saw the adjustments you're talking about. And I'm with you. I don't think I saw that during the course of this game in the second half. And I think they're well aware of it. And I think they realize that, hey, look, you know, you've got to try a couple of other things within the course of this. So I think your point is very well taken.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad because I rewatched the game and I talked to people about this, and there was just absolutely nothing. It's almost, I don't know, I don't want to use the term that they wanted to fail, but it's just mind-boggling that the fans can sit there and say, okay, this isn't working, we need to try something else, and see that shortly after the sacks took place, that, hey, okay, they got a recipe here, let's figure out something different and try it. And like you said, in the Boston College game, the Ohio State game, and the Central Florida game, it was like a different team out there. And
yeah,
but that part worries me. The other point I wanted to make is, and I brought this up to several people, and I've even read about this on some of the boards on Blue White and Fight on State and such. McSorley, now granted, I'm not saying he's a better quarterback in any way, shape, or form. I think Hack is a great quarterback, but under Franklin's offense, the style of offense that he likes to run, and with the situation that he has given with his offensive line, I heard McSorley move the ball effectively against the first team D, and that I'm just curious as to why it's almost as though he's afraid to put him in, because if he is successful, then he's going to be faced with a problem of, okay, the offense isn't suited for Hack, but it's suited more for a McSorley. Again, not saying McSorley is a better quarterback, just suited.
I understand.
He has different talents, And
I understand.
We haven't seen him yet.
Yeah, obviously I've seen a ton of them. So when he's moved the ball, Keith, it's actually been against the second team defense. And they try hard to match ones to ones and two to twos as often as possible. Not always. There are certain situations they'll put the twos against the ones, you know.
Right.
But for the most part, they try to match. Right. Yeah, they try to match it two to two for the most part. But you're right. I like the way Trace plays. Trace moves very well. Trace, even though he can run, is not a run first guy. I think he handles the offense well. The area where I think he's made the greatest improvement, Keith, I think is in the deep ball that he throws. I thought he was no better than okay at throwing the deep ball last year. I think he's much better at throwing it this year. I think he needs to get his feet wet in some games and to get into game speed first before anybody starts thinking about anything long-term with him. But I think when he gets in the game, I think you're going to like what you see from him. I think you have to sit back and ask yourself, okay, which quarterback at this particular moment on this day gives you the best chance to win? And it is obvious to anybody at this particular moment, Christian Hackenberg gives you the best chance to win a game. So that's why you go with him, because you're really doing things in the moment and not doing things with 2016 in mind. But McSorley needs to get in there at some point to get his feet wet, to get into game speed, and then start going from there.
You know, even if you get him in there, if he moves the ball a little bit, they do some, you know, a little this, a little that, and get these guys some confidence, okay? Because I see no confidence in this team. This team, there's nobody on that line that looks like they've taken a hold and like they're in command, and they're, you know, someone that really grabs your hold and says, listen, you gotta start blocking here. You know, you gotta pay attention here. I don't see that. I see bewilderment in your eyes, you know. And that part worries me. So I think anything that you can do right now to create a spark would help. And I think that maybe McSorley could provide that spark just based on being mobile. So
okay. Keith, thanks for your comments. Yeah, Keith, I appreciate your comments very much.
No problem. Okay. Yep.
Due to time, I'm going to go to Dick and Milton next. Hi, Dick.
Hey, no football today, Steve. But before I was a Baltimore Oriole fan, I was old enough to be a Brooklyn Dodger fan. So 66 okay. years of Vin Scully. Back then, that's all we had was radio. I mean, obviously, you didn't have TV when I was growing up, or very little. So next year will be his 67th year. To me, he is the greatest announcer in the history of baseball. And when you compare him to how many guys have announced and how many guys have actually played the game, it's beyond incredible. He really is.
Yeah,
he's just.
I agree with
he
you.
He actually, he's almost like a poet when he talks, or an artist when he's painting. He just. You mean you can actually see things that no other announcer could have you see. I don't care if it's a sunset out. It's just amazing. But I couldn't pass this opportunity up to say something about Vin Scully, because he is baseball to me.
Actually, Dick, the part, because it's at the beginning of the inning. I didn't play was the part where he says there's 29,000 at Dodger Stadium and a million butterflies.
It's just amazing how the guy, it's just incredible how the guy is. He's just, it's, I mean, you've been around baseball, you announce football, and there's been hundreds of announcers, and there's been thousands of players, but there's only one Vin Scully. I don't care what team you root for, there's only one. As many good announcers that there are over the years, whether it be Harry Carey or it doesn't matter, you can name a lot of them. But there's only one Vin Scully, and he will go down as the greatest announcer in the history of maybe all sports, to me anyhow.
I, Dick, have nothing there to disagree with you about. There's something about the artistry of the man that takes what we do and makes it into an art form.
And I don't think a lot of people realize this. If you actually listen to him, he did, and I'm sure he still does, because I think he does this with no color commentator. Pretty much everything he does is just on his own, sitting there. It's incredible.
He does. He has not worked with an analyst since the day Don Drysdale died.
Well, that's a long time ago, considering Drysdale pitched with Koufax. Dude, that's a long time ago. Anyhow,
Drysdale was his analyst, and then Drysdale... Own ever since.
Well, I still have a lot. Some of my old book on Dodger baseball cards. I mean, obviously they're long and old and whatever. Maybe I told you this, but my mother actually grew up in Newport, so she went to school with Billy Cox. So that's a long time ago. That's another story.
Wow.
He was a pretty good baseball player, not bad himself at third base. I mean, he doesn't get the acknowledgement of the Snyders and the Campanellas and the Hodgers and the Ferrellas and you know, Jackie Robinson or Gilliam. But he's pretty darn good. You know, when they played baseball with a pie can on their hand instead of a real baseball glove, literally.
That's right.
No pocket. Anyhow, hey, well, thanks. Just wanted to get that out there.
No problem. Yep. Due to time, we're going to get right into the break and come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
High fly ball into right field. She is gone.
Okay, guess the call.
Kirk Gibson off Dennis Eckersley, game one, 1988 World Series.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
So.
Second only to the national broadcast at that particular time, who I believe was Jack Buck.
That was the national.
Oh, was that the national broadcast?
Jack Buck was on radio.
Okay, well, that's what I meant. The national radio broadcast where Jack Buck says, "I don't believe what I just saw."
I just saw it. Scully's was on NBC TV.
You're right. That was a TV one.
It is the only play of the game I saw that night.
Really?
Penn State was playing Syracuse in football night game at Beaver Stadium. Syracuse won the game in 1988. And I came back up after doing the post-game show with Joe on the radio network. And when I came up our broadcast ended, I then walked over and there was a TV on in the booth one down from us. And that was on. And that's the only play I saw in the game. I went, wow.
Well, and you talk about
there's no sound either.
And you talk about setting the scene. I mean, here's Gibson walking up to the plate. It basically goes through the whole season history in about 5 seconds.
Until he was physically unable to start tonight with two bad legs, the bad left hamstring and the swollen right knee. And with two out, you talk about a roll of the dice. This is it.
He just went through the whole thing in about 5 seconds and set the whole scene for that particular moment.
Yeah, and then Eckersley, of course, had saved everything for years for Oakland. And, NBC had the World Series that year. ABC had it the next year, and that's when Al Michaels had the earthquake.
But you're right. I forgot he had the television broadcast. It was not the local broadcast. It was the television broadcast that he had. And then Jack Buck had the radio broadcast of it on CBS, as I recall at the time.
Yes, CBS radio. Yep, 50 years ago today, Sandy Koufax's perfect game. And I hope you enjoyed hearing arguably the best ever call, one of the great moments ever. Like I said, you know, whenever I have him on in the radio now, and that's one of the glories of as you drive as often as I have to drive, and you have SiriusXM, or now on MLB Network, I get to hear more of him. I feel like every time he's on, I'm having a learning experience as to what my profession can be. High school football previews tomorrow, and also a look at Buffalo, as we'll have Mark Gaughan from the Buffalo News to talk about the Bulls on News Radio 1070 WKOK.